Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, March 31st, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the Alice Corp versus CLS Bank case argued just earlier today in the U.S. Supreme Court. I am Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear from one expert today who was in the oral argument. Thank you for your efforts to get there this morning, Professor Mossoff. He's going to give us some opening remarks, first describing the case and its background, and then talking pretty extensively about what transpired at oral argument. He's going to do that in about 20 minutes' time or so. And then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions. I'm speaking today about our expert, Professor Adam Mossoff. He's a professor of law and co-director of academic programs and senior scholar of the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property at the George Mason University School of Law. That is a fairly new center to shine light on the protection of intellectual property at George Mason, of course. And if you haven't checked it out, Adam, if you want to, during your opening remarks, give us the website to direct us there, I certainly recommend it. But with that, Professor Mossoff, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean, and it's a real pleasure to be here to speak about the Alice Corp versus CLS Bank case that was heard in oral argument today with a decision that will likely come out sometime between now and the end of June. It will more likely than not, given the significance of this case and the far-reaching issues that it touches upon with respect to the patent system and innovation more generally in the high-tech industry, we'll probably not see a decision until late June. As Dean rightly pointed out, I am also a co-director of academic programs at the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property, and that website is cpip.gmu.edu. CPIP is cpip.gmu.edu. But more importantly, let's talk about Alice Corp versus CLS Bank. So in the first 20 minutes, I'm just going to quickly give a quick overview of the case. I'm going to give some highlights from the oral argument, and then I'll do what everyone, I think, really was waiting for, which is the proffer a guess as to what the Supreme Court actually may do in this case when a decision finally comes out. And then we'll hopefully have a nice, robust question and answer period, and can return to some more specific issues from the oral argument or the case more generally. So with respect to the case, for those of you who are patent law geeks or tech geeks and follow these issues very closely, you'll know that this case addresses for the first time whether computer programs or some software programs sometimes are referred to as, are actually patentable inventions and thus can be secured under the patent system with the legal protections that are provided to inventions and new technology for the term of a patent, which is 20 years from date of filing. In this case, Alice Corp owns a patent on a computer program that implements complex financial transactions between multiple parties. And it ensures through the program that the parties actually follow through on their commitments to either purchase a particular financial product or deliver the particular financial product. So it prevents people from effectively fudging on their commitments effectively in the market. CLS Bank has long been involved in complex international financial transactions, and Alice Corp was making some indications to it that what CLS Bank was doing infringed Alice Corp's patents. So CLS Bank brought what's called a declaratory judgment action in court, asking the federal court to invalidate Alice Corporation's patents for being invalid. Alice Corp then countersued for patent infringement. And the district court ultimately ruled, in fact, that Alice Corp's patents were invalid. It went up to the Federal Circuit, and through multiple iterations of the Federal Circuit ultimately heard the case en banc, which means all judges in the Federal Circuit heard the case, with a decision that came out almost about a year ago, May 10th, 2013, and it resulted in an extremely fractured decision. So there were seven separate opinions totaling 68 total pages in the Federal Reporter, Case Reporter, with no one opinion garnering a majority of the court. Ultimately, the decision of the court was a one-paragraph per curiam, meaning unsigned decision, and ultimately what that one paragraph held was all of the patents were invalid. And so as a result of this extremely fractured decision, it was very little surprise that the U.S. Supreme Court granted the cert petition by Alice Corp back in December 6, 2013 to hear the case. And the case is, since it directly addresses whether computer programs such as, you know, Word for Windows, your email client, Outlook or Thunderbird, your web browsers, whether, you know, Mozilla or Explorer or Chrome, whether these are actually patentable inventions or not, along with the particular type of computer program that's used and covered in this case, which is this computer program for implementing financial transactions of sales of financial products. You know, it has generated a lot of concern and interest because a lot of companies, of course, use software both in the high-tech industry as well as even in the non-high-tech industries, kind of traditional industries. I mean, people are not aware of the fact of how ubiquitous software is today. It's in everything. It's in our coffee machines. It's in our automobiles. It's in addition to it being in our phones and other types of things. So it's a very significant innovative product, and it is something that is actually has been covered by patents for at least 10, 15 years now, explicitly and implicitly, and fits and starts for about 10 years before that. And so there was, as I said, a significant amount of interest in this. In this case, 41 amicus briefs were filed, in addition to the Solicitor General filing a brief, and actually the Solicitor General was given 10 minutes of the oral argument time. So at root, as I said, the question was whether software programs, which are referred to in the legal briefs as computer-implemented inventions, whether these actually count as patentable discoveries or are they abstract ideas that are traditionally and historically been excluded from the patent system. So, for instance, E equals MC squared is an abstract idea that that is not a patentable invention. But nuclear technology, like the technology that goes into a nuclear reactor or a nuclear bomb, that is a patentable invention. That's an applied aspect of the idea in the real world. It's concrete, it's specific, it produces specific results in the real world, and therefore that would be a patentable invention. So the question is, on what side of this divide between abstract idea and patentable technology does computer software fall upon? So I'm just going to give a couple quick brief highlights from the oral argument. I can't touch on every aspect of it, but I'll touch on the aspects that I think people would find of most interest before garnering my guess as to where the Supreme Court may go with this in this case. So the case opened, of course, with arguments from the petitioner, Alice Corp, who's actually the patent owner in this case. The argument by Alice Corp's counsel could be essentially summarized as repeatedly emphasizing to the justices the very specific nature of the function of the software program in this case, that it, you know, that it addresses these complex financial transactions that are most of which occur in an international context through the creation of very specific types of accounts known in the financial world as shadow accounts, as a way to protect the parties to a transaction from one party not fulfilling their commitments on the transaction. And in fact, the very first question from Justice Kennedy as to whether the very first question in the oral argument was from Justice Kennedy, who asked specifically, is this patented invention an abstract idea or not? So you can see how the immediate answer to that was no, because it's a specific idea about a very specific program and a specific way of engaging in financial transactions that are not possible to engage in without a computer program, given the complexity of these transactions. And then that became kind of the overarching theme of Alice Corp's argument for the next 18 minutes, because the counsel reserved time for rebuttal at the very end. And in fact, it bears noting that this concern about, you know, what is an abstract idea also ran throughout the entire case, although it very rarely was explicitly asked again and again and again in any particular way. So it was asked kind of at the get-go from Justice Kennedy. He said, is this invention an abstract idea? Big not a big surprise that Alice Corp's argument was no in response to that, being the owner of the patent. And at the very end, the very last question actually asked by one of the justices in this oral argument was by Justice Ginsburg, and it was directed to the Solicitor General. And she actually asked the Solicitor General, well, how do you define an abstract idea? How do you define what makes something an abstract idea versus something that's patentable or not? And which is very interesting because it was very interesting that happened to be the last question that was asked, because actually that is the 100% crux of this case. That's the legal question in this case. How do you define an abstract idea in a way that is understood such that you know what is patentable and what is not? Justice Breyer then kind of picked up the some of the questioning, significant questioning in the case with respect to Alice Corp's counsel, and he eventually framed, I think, what was one of the one of the underlying concerns in this case in terms of its in terms of the implications or potential practical results, which is, he said, there's really a dilemma that's presented here, right? He said, on the one hand, we don't want valid business practices being unduly monopolized. So, you know, we don't want people who just have an idea of engaging in financial transactions, that should be an idea that should be part of the business practices more generally. It shouldn't be fall under the protections of the patent system. And so we need to make sure that people are free to use those types of ideas. But on the other hand, we don't want to block real inventions from access to the protections being provided by the patent system. The patent system performs a very important function in both incentivizing new inventions and in making it possible by securing property rights in these inventions, making it possible for commercial firms in the marketplace to bring these inventions to the market by making possible the creation of the contracts and other types of complex financial arrangements that are involved in going from the idea in the lab all the way to a final product held in someone's hand by a consumer in a mall, for instance, like an iPhone. And Justice Breyer kind of kept pressing all of the attorneys, in fact, throughout the entire oral argument, not just Alice Corp's attorney, but also the attorney for CLS Bank and the Solicitor General, for a formulation of a legal rule. He said, how can we have what legal rule could we come up with that helps us avoid the horns of this dilemma of either unduly monopolizing ideas that should be free, or overkill by coming up with a legal rule that's too restrictive and preventing valid inventions from securing the legitimate protections of the patent system. In fact, at one point during the argument from CLS Bank's attorney, he actually said that what he was looking for was, quote, the right words, unquote. So it was clear that Justice Breyer was really trying to struggle here with trying to come up with a proper formulation of a legal rule that he could then deploy in the patent system and in patent jurisprudence that could effectively secure legitimate inventions and prevent abstract ideas from getting into the patent system. It also bears noting that Justice Breyer at one point said, you know, look, I've really studied all of these issues, you know, this case very well. There are 42 briefs filed in addition to the party's briefs, and I read them all, and I found them all very helpful, and I understood them completely. And then he said, but of course, you know, applying, you know, them to the how to resolve this case has been very hard, and I don't have an answer to that from those briefs, which brought some laughter from the audience. But he mentioned, in fact, there were only two amicus briefs that actually were ever mentioned during the oral argument. One was by Tony Dutra, a former software engineer and very knowledgeable about this area, as well as IBM. Amicus brief. In fact, the counsel for Alice Corporation continually hit on a theme from the IBM brief, which was also a theme that was emphasized in Judge Moore's opinion in the en banc decision in the Federal Circuit below, which was one of the seven opinions, that if patents on software are deemed to be or if software is deemed to be unpatentable, so if patents on software are deemed as a class to be invalid, then this would invalidate whole swaths of valid inventions that have become central to the economy of this country. So this would invalidate hundreds of thousands of patents that have issued in the past 10 to 20 years, and would end up invalidating inventions in computer technology that everyone seemed to be assuming, including the justices as well as the attorneys, to be valid patents. patents covering web browsing technology, patents covering email clients, patents covering encryption programs, which is one of the examples given in the IBM brief, which showed the extent to which actually the justices and some of the counsels that had read IBM's brief in this case. And so it appears that IBM's amicus brief will be one of the briefs that will actually potentially have some significant influence on the justices and perhaps coming to a resolution in this case. Now, when the attorney for CLS Bank then got up to give his argument, I mean, you basically could summarize his argument as the court should follow its recent decisions in Bilski versus Kappos and Mayo versus Prometheus and hold Alice's patent to be invalid, he said. In Bilski, you said you cannot patent abstract ideas. In Mayo versus Prometheus, which is actually a case involving a method of diagnosing someone with a particular medical condition, and they said that was law of nature, so it was a method patent, a process patent, and Bilski was an abstract idea case. He said, you know, those cases directly suggest to this court that you should follow this precedent and hold the patent in this case to be invalid. Now, it's very interesting that several of the justices, including Justices Kennedy, Sotomayor, and Kagan, repeatedly pressed CLS Bank's counsel on what he would consider to be a valid patent on either a particular type of computer program or a computer process. Now, at one point, he gave as an example what he thought might be a valid patent on a particular computer program to be streaming video. He said that I think would be a valid patent and a valid technology that could be secured under the patent system. But he had a much harder time with identifying process patents. Patents on the methods of doing things, because this was implied by his argument from Bilski and from Mayo that methods are abstract ideas or laws of nature and are therefore not patentable. And so he had a very hard time framing whether the processes that are entailed in email and word processing programs could themselves be patentable inventions. And at one point he basically suggested that yes, they could be as long as they represented a, quote, technological advance, unquote. And although what that particularly means is was left undefined and is open to interpretation, but he at least conceded that, you know, where email and word processing would have been patentable when they were first invented, at least as an historical matter. Of course, whether they would be today now is a separate question, which raises the question of whether CLS Bank was arguing that what counts as something being patentable or not is basically historically dependent or not, which would be a very strange idea, since the idea that, you know, since this is supposed to be a long-standing historical test that no abstract ideas can be patented, no laws of nature can be patented, and other types of things. Justice Kagan also repeatedly touched on the question of, well, how much does one have to describe how to implement an invention, how to implement a particular method or a particular product in order for it to be a valid patent? This how question she kept returning to, and several other justices did as well. And it was a question, again, that the CLS Bank, he had a hard time with it, but he ultimately gave an answer, a two-part answer. He said, which he said was a negative part and a positive part. He says the negative one is that the claim shouldn't just recite, the patent claim shouldn't just recite a particular result in the real world achieved by that method. He said that is invalid. And the court had made clear in Bilski and in its prior cases that type of approach is invalid. He says, and then positively, he said, I think that what the claim must do is it must recite, quote, significantly more than the abstract idea itself, end quote. And there he was explicitly invoking language from the court's recent decision in Mayo versus Prometheus. So again, he continually invoked the Supreme Court's recent precedents and basically was continually telling the justices, you've ruled on this issue before, you know what you have to do again in this case. A very powerful type of argument to make for an attorney. Now, the Solicitor General then was given 10 minutes to argue, and the Solicitor General essentially argued that patents should only issue for something that advances the, quote, technological arts, end quote. Now, the Solicitor General was actually pressed very hard on how to apply this test. And Justice Kennedy, for example, ultimately said, give me one example of a valid business method patent that meets this test. Because in Bilski, they did say that business methods were patentable, even though the particular business method in that case counted as an abstract idea. They said as a class, business methods could be patentable. And this question from Justice Kennedy was actually likely prompted by the counsel for Alice Corporation, who preempted the Solicitor General a little bit by arguing very forcefully that the Solicitor General was essentially trying to relitigate its loss in Bilski. In Bilski, the Solicitor General said there should be no patents at all on business methods. And its brief, as a de facto matter, essentially makes that point again, too. And so Alice Corp. So the counsel really tried to bring that out from that from the Solicitor General's brief, and so the Solicitor General kept getting hit on this point: is, well, can you point us to a valid business method or a valid process patent in the computer technological, in the computer field, a computer implemented technology that you would think is valid or not? And unfortunately, I think for the Solicitor General, he confirmed the concern that was raised by Alice Corp's counsel about what that he was trying to do, because he ultimately conceded that it's, quote, difficult for me to do this, end quote. And then he then said, well, maybe encryption, an encryption process on the use of computer credit cards for purchases, maybe that could potentially be a valid process patent that doesn't count as an abstract idea. But the problem for him was that he immediately then began to argue, though, well, but frequent flyer programs adopted by airlines and Moneyball methodology for Moneyball methodology is the famous baseball methodology of identifying high-performing baseball players who are not recognized for their skills, and it's been deployed in other areas. Well, those clearly are not patentable processes, but. Which really raises the question is, yeah, but then at what at root, or at least what in principle, distinguishes even an encryption process from a frequent flyer program or a Moneyball process? And in fact, when Alice Corp's counsel got up at the very end, in his rebuttal, he actually made this point. He said, you know, it's somewhat disingenuous. He didn't use those explicit words, but it was the point he was making, of the Solicitor General to be arguing these issues, because if Alice Corp's patent covered an encryption program, that they would be here arguing that encryption is an abstract idea, because it's a very old idea. Encryption has long existed. It goes back thousands of years, right? I mean, the ancient Greeks and the Romans used it as a way to pass very, you know, secret military messages and whatnot, and it's something that's been used and deployed in war and in business for a very, very long time. And so for all the same reasons that they would argue that frequent flyer programs and Moneyball and other types of methodologies, and their argument is that the patent in this case is an old idea and an abstract idea, you know, that it that for the very reason that they would suggest that that was invalid, you know, it shows that there's no limit to the rule that they're arguing. It would invalidate all business methods and all and effectively all computer programs that deploy processes. So some just quick general remarks in the oral argument before I turn this over to the question and answer period. But Justice Breyer proved to be his usual insightful as well as entertaining participant in the oral argument process. For those who follow patent cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, you know that Justice Breyer is known for coming up with very colorful hypotheticals to ask of the attorneys, and he didn't fail to do so in this case either. He out of the gate, he came up with a hypothetical involving King Tut having one of his officials use an abacus to do calculations on his abacus for a financial transaction, and then tells him to stop at the, you know, at a particular moment. He said, you know, isn't that basically the idea that what Alice Corp is trying to patent here in this case with its patent on financial transactions? And then he later came up with, my mother controls a checkbook and tells me to stop, you know, using the checkbook, again hitting on the point of this is just a basic idea being deployed in financial methodologies of tracking money and following transactions. And then later he actually, later in the oral argument, he came up with a hypothetical involving Archimedes basically saying to a boat builder, apply my ideas. So he continued continued to come up with his usual colorful hypotheticals in trying to test the limits and soft points of counsel's argument. Interestingly enough, Justice Scalia did not ask very many questions. He was not particularly or thoroughly engaged in this oral argument, and he often is someone who's deeply engaged in oral arguments, so that was very fascinating to note that. Most of the questions came from Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, Kagan, Roberts, and Ginsburg. And they repeatedly showed concern about the implications of eliminating all patents on software programs generally. They repeatedly asked questions about how do we frame a legal rule that limits it such that we don't wipe out what we would think to be or what they clearly assume to be valid patents covering valid technological innovations in the high-tech industry on computer-implemented inventions. But they also, the justices also repeatedly showed that they seem to still be fundamentally confused about what is the nature of a Section 101 patentable subject matter inquiry and how that relates to the other patentability requirements set forth in Sections 102, 103, and 112 of the Patent Act, which set forth the novelty requirements, the non-obviousness requirement, the written disclosure requirement, and utility requirements. Unfortunately, there was very little to no guidance from counsel in breaking through this confusion. And it wasn't just confusion about the law and what are legal requirements. There was also confusion about the basic technology that we're asking is covered. Is this covered or not by the patent system? For instance, no one bothered to ever ask the question, neither justices nor counsel, what is a software patent? Even though this was a term that everyone used, the justices, the attorneys, and everyone. Because this is software patent, it bears emphasizing, is not a term of art in patent law. Is not a category that the Patent Office issues patents under. You will search in vain at the Patent Office for patents that are defined as or categorized as software patents. And so it's a very amorphous rhetorical term that's used in the public policy debates, but it doesn't really have any definitive settled meaning in the law. And so it's of some concern that is not even being addressed or recognized by the people who are asking and who are ultimately will be in charge of deciding, the justices themselves will be in charge of deciding whether computer-implemented technology, which is how it was framed in the briefs, whether that, in fact, is a sufficient invention that deserves protection under the patent system. So what to make of this? I don't have my tea leaves reading skills honed up on of late, so it's very hard to predict what the Supreme Court will do, especially from oral argument. But I think the easy money prediction here, if there is one, is that the Supreme Court will likely hand down something like its Bilski v. Kappos decision. As I said earlier, Bilski v. Kappos was a question of whether business methods are patentable or not. In that case, the court said, well, as a class, business methods can be patentable, but in this particular case, the business method is not patentable. It's an abstract idea. So in this case, what you may see is the court saying, well, software as a class is patentable. Of course, they probably will never define that term. Software as a class is patentable, but this particular patent is not. It's an abstract idea. Because the justices seem to be falling along the Bilski fault lines that you saw in that case with Breyer and Ginsburg. And Sotomayor in Bilski expressing substantial concerns and ultimately actually arguing that there shouldn't be patents on business methods. And in Bilski, Kennedy was joined by Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and a portion of his opinion was joined by Scalia ultimately arguing that, well, business methods can be patentable in principle, just this one is an abstract idea. But of course, this ultimately shows the ongoing problem with not just Bilski, but with this case, if they go that route, because Bilski is exactly why we're in this mess today. Because in Bilski, they gave zero guidance and zero instruction to the Federal Circuit or to district courts or to counsel as to what counts as an abstract idea. In Bilski, the Justice Kennedy basically says, Well, this business, particular business method, is an abstract idea because it's abstract, because it's long known and it's abstract. And so there's been zero guidance for the courts, which explains partially why the Federal Circuit is fractured so badly, because the Federal Circuit is very much at sea without any law to guide them. And if they go the same route in computer software, then this will continue to be an ongoing problem faced by not only inventors, but by the many businesses and firms that rely upon the patent system to both create and to bring to market and to put into the hands of the consumer the patented technology that we all now take for granted as part of modern life. And I'm talking about our smartphones and our tablets and our wireless access and all the other technologies that have been covered by patents and have been brought to us as patented innovation. So with that, I'll turn it over for questions from the audience, and I thank you for listening to this podcast.
Well, thank you, Professor. In a moment, we're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, Anna Mossoff, today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we turn to our audience, let me make an announcement that tomorrow at 2 p.m. we'll be discussing a topic that probably should be of interest to folks on this call, and that is the extent to which the government is giving up control of the Internet. We could cite a Washington Post headline in their technology section that says, U.S. to relinquish remaining control over the Internet. That's our topic tomorrow at 2 p.m. Then on Thursday, we'll be talking about the obligations of state attorneys general to enforce and defend state laws. We might also schedule in other teleforums, so do check our website for updates and monitor your emails as well. We've got four callers with questions at this point in time, so let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. One of the roles I played in life is as a computer programmer. So I've developed a lot of software that some might try to patent. And from that perspective, I'd have to say that some software is in principle patentable because it's not obvious. Most software is obvious. The test I would suggest would be if you can put together a team of ordinary programmers on a task and they come up with it, it's not patentable. On the other hand, if it's some algorithm that leading mathematicians have struggled with for decades before someone finally solved it, then that's not obvious and therefore in principle patentable. But the key criterion should be it's how obvious it is, not whether it's software.
Professor Mossoff?
Yes, I think the questioner has asked or made an excellent point, which bears emphasizing. It was never actually stated by the at any point in the oral argument, which was a little surprising, which is that, you know, when you're talking about whether something is a patentable invention under Section 101 of the Patent Act, so whether this actually kind of counts as technology as such. That's a question that precedes the analysis that the caller just made about whether something is obvious or not, which is actually the requirement in Section 103 of the Patent Act. And in fact, the Supreme Court has emphasized in its prior cases in this area that you need to do the patentable subject matter analysis first before you get to the novelty discussion and, you know, requirement in 101. The 102, I apologize, 102, the non-obviousness in 103, or the written disclosure requirements in 112. What a lot of people think, well, this computer program is totally obvious, it shouldn't be patented or not, you know, but that's an analysis that occurs in 103, and we're kind of preempting that whole analysis by engaging in this discussion in 101 as to whether this is actually an abstract idea or not. In fact, when you actually kind of look at the substance of what the court is getting at implicitly when they talk about, well, this is an abstract idea, or in Mayo, which involved a method for testing for a diagnostic condition, a diagnostic method for testing for a condition, a medical condition, you know, and they, in that case, they said it was a law of nature. When you hear them talking about it, they're like, well, this doesn't involve an inventive step. This, you know, this is a small, this really isn't something that's a significant leap over what was known before. And that's exactly the type of analysis that should be engaged in and is supposed to be engaged in under Section 103 under non-obviousness. That's not supposed to be a patentable subject matter inquiry, and yet the court is shoehorning that into Section 101 as part of its patentable subject matter jurisprudence. And in doing so, it's ripping kind of traditional legal concepts from their framework, from their tests, and are deploying them willy-nilly in a way that then people don't know, well, what is really going on here? How is the court ultimately going to apply this? How do I make an argument? What counts as a legitimate argument or not to a court? And that's really one of the real problems here. As I mentioned, the real problem in the Bilski case is, you know, they said this is abstract. And then when you kind of looked at, well, what do you mean by it's abstract? Well, because he felt like it was either not novel at times or it was obvious, which is not what the inquiry should be under Section 101. And so there seems to be a confusion in the court that they really think like that 101 is really it. You know, that's the analysis that you need to engage in, despite sometimes, you know, some perfunctory comments about how, yes, you know, and then there's these later tests. But you know, they don't realize that just because something counts under 101 doesn't mean you get a patent on it. So just because you say it's patent eligible as subject matter, as a new invention, as a new process, or a new manufacturer, what we'd refer to just in regular language as a product, that doesn't necessarily mean you get a patent on it. You know, it may still not be novel, it may still be obvious, and that's exactly why we have these other statutory requirements to police people applying for patent protections in the patent system. So, thank you.
Very good. We're still at four questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Gregory Dolan from University of Baltimore. Thank you, Adam, for a very illuminating discussion. And I have a short and perhaps somewhat silly question. In some ways, I wonder if anybody brought up the fact that I taught Bilski just the other day, or retaught it again, and in light of CLS Bank, it struck me that Bilski actually has a line in it. It says, we can't take the machine transformation test or proposed by the Federal Circuit. We can't take this view that none of this is patent eligible, precisely because if we do, this is going to throw into doubt a lot of software patents. They actually, at least the majority, the five-person majority, expresses this worry explicitly. And I was wondering if that written worry of 3 or 4 years ago has made itself known either in questions or has been advanced in sort of in answers, and how that sort of, that ended up playing with the justices and advocates.
So thank you, Greg, for that great question. And it was one of the themes that the counsel for Alice Corp hit upon, in addition to his repeated point that, well, this is a specific invention for a specific type of process or in system, and therefore it should be patentable. He did state, and he stated again in his rebuttal, that, you know, if you hold in this case that software as a class is unpatentable, or if you hand down a legal rule that invalidates this patent and calls into doubt software patents generally, however we may define that term, you are calling into question hundreds of thousands of patents. And he did explicitly say at one point in time in the oral argument, he said, that is not the role for this court. That if that type of action is going to be taken with tremendous economic consequences for not just hundreds of thousands of patent owners, but thousands of businesses and millions of consumers and a whole industry that accounts for a significant portion of the United States innovation economy, that needs to be addressed by Congress, not the court, and that this is not the place this is not something that the court should be considering or even engaging in if that is going to be a byproduct of its decision. He did emphasize, and then in connection with that, he emphasized that, oh, and by the way, you know, Congress has returned repeatedly to the question of revising the patent system. It did so in 2011 with the American Invents Act. It's considering doing so again right now with a significant number of bills being considered on the Hill to revise the patent system. And he emphasized that, you know, the Congress has been repeatedly revising the patent system since Bilski was decided, and since software patents have been granted and have been used in the marketplace. And Congress has never indicated that it's been willing to eradicate this practice, that it thinks that this is an invalid application of the patent statutes that has enacted and has repeatedly revised in the ensuing time period. So he was at least impliedly invoking several kind of long-standing canons of statutory interpretation, and at least a significant policy concern that, as you noted, was raised in Bilski about the implications of a type of decision that could end up invalid. Hundreds of thousands of patents.
Once again, we're speaking with Professor Adam Ossoff. If you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
This is Marianne McGrail, an attorney in D.C. Was there any discussion at all in the oral argument or in the briefs that you read of the copyrightability of software, and did the EFF, did the Electronic Frontier Foundation file an amicus, and was there any discussion of the open source initiative?
Thank you. Yes. There were parties among AMSI who did mention that just because if you strike down patent protection on software, that does not mean that there is no legal protection for software, that there not only remains copyright protection, but that there also remains trade secret protection and even trademark protection, which are different types of protections that are deployed even in the open source community. They use trademark protections extensively. So it was not discussed or raised in the oral argument, but it is something that I actually have touched upon in some of my prior work about why the shift from copyright to patent occurred in the 1980s and 90s with the rise of the personal computer revolution, where software becomes a separate product from the hardware that is running on it. You end up with the personal computer revolution, you end up with true general computers that can then be used for any specific type of program or activity, given a program that you can load upon it and run it, that can be used in a wide swath of different types of computers. And in fact, that is exactly why they moved away from copyright protection, because the value in software becomes the function to the user, the word processing program, the spreadsheet program, the email program. It becomes the experience by the user as a product on your computer and in the marketplace and using your home, and that is not what is secured by copyright. Copyright just secures the literal expression of the code, but as every computer programmer knows, you can recreate whole cloth the experience of a computer program with entirely different code. So in that respect, the value that's secured by copyright no longer maps onto the commercial value that is being sold and purchased by users in the marketplace when it comes to software, which is the program as it's experienced by the end user. And that's why there was the shift to patent in the 1990s with an explicit recognition that copyright does not do this in the famous case Borland v. Lotus. And actually, as I said, I've written on this, and I've written a small essay on this called A Brief History of Software Patents and Why They're Valid that actually can be downloaded at the website at cpip.gmu.edu. But it was not discussed at length not mentioned in the oral argument, and it was not really discussed in the party's briefs. It was mentioned in some of the AMSI briefs.
Thank you. Is your website on the GMU, on your GMU faculty page?
It's linked to there, yes, but if you just go to cpip.gmu.edu and you go to publications, you'll find a listing for policy briefs, and it's there.
Thank you.
We've got two callers in the queue right now. If you'd like to ask a question, we've got some time left. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, it's Andy Schlafly with Eagle Forum. Thanks for that excellent presentation. Years ago, the Supreme Court said that algorithms were not patentable, and there are a couple clear decisions on that going back many decades, but it seems as though software has gotten around that, and it seems as though if someone simply writes a software program that embodies an algorithm, then the software is patentable, and based on the presentation this afternoon, it looks like the court is going to uphold the patentability of software. Did the issue of algorithms come up at all, and how the court might reconcile its decisions from decades ago that algorithms are not patentable with its apparent view today that software is patentable?
The issue of algorithms was not explicitly mentioned, although the case in which the U.S. Supreme Court actually first mentions that algorithms, in fact, the very first case in which they use that term, the U.S. Supreme Court, is Gottschalk v. Benson, and that is actually a computer software case. So, in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court did not rule specifically that algorithms are not patentable until they were faced with computer software, and it's relevant somewhat that the Benson case occurred in 1972, when you still did not yet have the personal computer revolution that occurs at the end of the 70s and early 1980s, when software is still linked very much with hardware, the computer hardware that runs it, both in the real world, just as end users experience it, but also as a commercial product. Excuse me, and so. I would actually suggest that while this is not kind of an ongoing, this was not raised in the case because they focused more on the abstract idea issue, the algorithm issue does not really provide a definitive answer. In fact, it's sown, I believe, just like abstract idea, it's sown a lot more confusion than it has actually clarity. Because an algorithm, by definition, is just a process for answering a particular problem. And so, for instance, you can have mathematical algorithms, you can have all types of algorithms. And this is a common argument you hear. Well, 2 plus 2 equals 4, that's not patentable. A computer program which runs on binary code, which is effectively ones and zeros, is effectively 2 plus 2 equals 4, ergo computer software should not be patentable. That's a somewhat oversimplification, but that's essentially the type of argument that one hears when people say that computer software should not be patentable. But that is an argument that proves too much, right, in two ways. First, yes, 2 plus 2 equals 4 is not patentable, but a word processing program, so Word for Windows or Word Perfect, is not 2 plus 2 equals 4. I mean, it's a program where you are producing, it is a program in which you produce a typewritten, stylized, formatted document, and that, in fact, is the commercial value and why people are willing to spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And back in the 1980s, they were willing to go to Egghead computer stores, for those of us who are old enough to remember those stores, to purchase these programs because they perform a particular type of function. It's not just that 2 plus 2 equals 4. We actually get something out of it. In effect, what the Federal Circuit said in the 1990s was that programs are digital machines, in the equivalent of it. And that's, I think, is a useful metaphor because, in effect, what a word processing program is a digital equivalent of a typewriter. And if a typewriter is patentable, and it clearly was, it was patented when it was discovered in the 1860s, a more complicated, novel, non-obvious, useful, fully disclosed digital version of that in the 21st century is a type of technology should be patented just as the same technology or the equivalent technology was patented in the 19th century. And then the other point, the reason why that argument proves too much is that all inventions are ultimately reducible down to algorithms. Again, it's a point that I make in my essay on the brief history of software patents. So in this sense, it's an argument that proves too much because you can reduce all inventions, all processes, especially all processes and methods, down to scientific formulas that reflect the laws of physics. From thermodynamics to energy transmission and other types of issues. And yes, so you can reduce a computer program down to mathematical equations, but you can, as I said, you can do that for for every process and activity that occurs in the real world, as people who take physics and chemistry know. In fact, as people know, physicists love to say that math is the universal language, it's the language of the universe. So we need to be careful about the types of arguments that we're making, and this is actually reflected by the justices in the oral argument. A lot of the justices repeatedly showed concern about adopting a rule that went too far, that had, too high of, was over-inclusive on the abstract idea and ended up wiping out valid, legitimate inventions, which the justices and the attorneys seemed to agree on they could have valid patents on computer software programs. And the examples that were continually bandied about by the justices and the council were streaming video, email, word processing programs, and encryption. The case Benson was mentioned. The explicit issue about algorithms was not mentioned. It was more, but the oral argument focused more on issues like what abstract idea, which is what was explicitly brought back into patent jurisprudence in Bilski.
We've got about 10 minutes left. We've got two callers with questions pending. Let's try to get to both of them.
Hi, this is Lenore Ostrovsky. I wanted you to go back to the word abstract. One of the comments that a lot of techies make about lawyers and judges is that lawyers and judges get very confused when they deal with the electrical engineering part of computers. That is, what does it mean when you send a signal over a computer? Does any sending of any signal over a computer turn it into a machine or transformation? So you didn't mention it, so I'm assuming that the justices didn't attempt to define the word abstract or deal with the tangible versus non-tangible aspect of it, and instead dealt with what you have already discussed, which is the really going into the obviousness versus non-obviousness, rather than the subject matter itself.
Oh, thank you, Lenore. That's an excellent question, and you're right. There was no actual explicit attempt as such to define abstract. In fact, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, there was only one justice who at one point asked explicitly, "How do you define an abstract idea?" It was the very last question asked of the council, and it was asked of the Solicitor General, who gave the answer that was unsatisfying. He said, "Well, it's a claim that is not direct. A patent claim is not directed to a concrete manifestation in science, technology, or in art." Which is an utterly, for lack of a better word, meaningless definition in the law and in technology for what counts as abstract. It was implicit in some of what the issue about tangible versus non-tangible was implicit in some of what the counsel for Alice Corp kept emphasizing about how this is a specific process that dictates specific types of steps in a specific type of financial transaction with specific steps that needed to occur, like the creation of these accounts called shadow accounts and things of that sort. So that was, as I said, implicit. The issue that you raised about tangible versus non-tangible was implicit in that, but it really wasn't brought out. And really, I mean, my perspective on this is the abstract idea and what counts as an abstract idea is kind of a Gordian knot of a patent law. It's kind of a foundational question. And actually, patent law in this respect is very similar to all other areas of law. All other areas of law reduce down to kind of foundational concepts, which are very, very difficult to define. Lawyers know them very well, at least from their 1L classes in torts. How do you define negligence in contracts? How do you define a meeting of the minds? I mean, these are real, this is the metaphysics of the law. In fact, Justice Joseph Story once referred to patent law as the closest to what we would call the metaphysics of the law. He said that in 1840. So this has long been recognized as kind of a foundational, difficult, very conceptually difficult question and issue to address. And it is one that a lot of, you'd be surprised, even a lot of lawyers complain about, that there isn't a proper, sufficient definition of abstract, even in the law, for them to understand how to apply it as a legal matter.
Thank you.
All right, we've got a few minutes. Thank you, Lenore. We've got a few minutes left. One final question, looks like. Let's go to our final caller.
That was a great summary, Dean. It's Susan Braden. I just wanted to tell you that the case you want to cite is not Lotus Borgnardt, but Computer Associates versus Altai. Really started, that case was issued before Borland. And I was Altai's lawyer. That's all I have to say. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you, Judge Braden.
Thank you, Judge Braden. Yes. I usually only mention the Borland case if only because that's for two reasons. One is it's a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court with a 4-4 split decision that really highlights and brings to bear the important aspect of copyright, which is that copyright secures only expression, not functionality. And for those who don't know the case was where they effectively tried to obtain copyright protection for pull-down menus in the very famous Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet program, and the court said you can't have copyright protection for pull-down menus. That's a functional aspect of the program. That's not actually the expression of the code. That's not the code itself. And one of the reasons I like Borland is that the decision in Borland coincides very closely with the decision in In Re Allopat in 1994, which is, as many people in patent law know, is the decision where the Federal Circuit holds that computer programs as such are patentable for all intents and purposes as digital machines. And so there's a nice symmetry there in terms of their historical and intellectual development that's the reason why I highlight that. But you're certainly right. There are other cases that they discuss this issue and discuss it very, very well, such as the case that you worked on.
Terrific. Well, we've got a minute or two. I want to give you a final opportunity to wrap up, Professor Mossoff, and maybe in doing that, maybe you can say a little bit more about how helpful your predicted outcome of the case, how helpful to the innovation economy that might or might not be, and then give us any final thoughts you might have as we conclude here today.
Yeah. Well, my prediction, which I referred to earlier this afternoon, is my 2 cents, and I don't even know if it's even worth that. But my prediction that they may pull something similar to what they pulled in Bilski would not be good for the innovation economy. As I said, the reason why we are in this kind of jurisprudential mess is partially because of Bilski, because that courts and lawyers and the companies responsible for creating not only new innovation but bringing it into the hands of consumers through creating and investing in the complex market mechanisms that make it possible to deploy new innovation into the market. They are given very little guidance in Bilski, and if the court pulls a very similar move in this case, they'd be given very little guidance in Alice Corp. And the thing that most kills people's ability to make millions of multi-million dollar investments is uncertainty about whether you can actually get legal protection for what you're engaging in down the road. And I'd like just take this quick moment to disabuse people of an error that they think that computer program is easy and costless. Yes, there are some programs like your apps on your phones and stuff that are very easy to produce and to make, and some people make them. But the programs that we come to rely upon on a day-to-day basis in our lives, our word processing programs, our operating systems, those programs involve tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of lines of code, and they involve millions, tens of millions, if not billions of dollars of development costs ex ante before a single product is sold in the marketplace. If we don't remember that, and IBM's amicus brief touched on this issue very, very well, which is one reason why I think it was mentioned in oral argument, then we really risk the great innovation that's been produced in the high-tech industry through the patent system, and we risk losing what many people now take for granted, and that would be a very, very unfortunate development, especially if it occurs at the hands of the Supreme Court. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Professor. My thanks to Professor Adam Mossoff for not only for attending oral argument this morning, of course, but for joining us on our teleforum call today. And to our audience, thank you for dialing in and for your participation. A reminder that tomorrow we'll be discussing a somewhat related topic. That's the control of the Internet and the U.S. role in the control of the Internet. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m., but until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.